Hello, everyone, and welcome to The Printcast, a podcast about the expanding world of printmaking today. I'm your host, Nick Naughton. The Printcast brings you interviews with some of the best contemporary printmakers, sharing anecdotes, business ideas, and technical tips with listeners everywhere. It's like print porn for your ears. Today's episode features the founder of a community print shop in Chicago. There's a special place in my heart for the Windy City, and I'm pleased to share this one with you today. I've always been a supporter of community print shops. In fact, this is the second shop of this type that I'm featuring on this podcast. If you check back to episode 6, that was the one where I talked to Print Shop LA, a similar but different print studio that's here in Los Angeles. Sputnik Press was put on my radar about 10 years ago when I landed a job running a studio in Kansas City. I was researching and looking for successful models anywhere I could find them, and one such shop was Clicking Away in Chicago, run by Angie Leonard. She started Sputnik Press with the drive to create something that could serve a community of artists and create a hub where people could work together, share equipment, and teach others about the printing arts. It's not a simple business to run, and it takes a lot of elbow grease and persistence to create this type of print studio and make it sustainable. Sputnik has been going for 13 years now, which is pretty incredible considering it started from Angie's apartment. The artists there work together to maintain the space and activate it with lots of programs, including publishing prints with outside guest artists. This is a good episode if you love print and the community it fosters. Now, speaking of community, I wanted to do something today. I wanted to bring up a few announcements, kind of to give back, but to also just highlight some things that I'm really excited about. You know, I can't be like a news feed for everything happening in printmaking because each week new things come up and it's just like hard, you know, to find it all, to find a way to share it all with you. But also, you know, it's like subjective as to what I see and what is actually going on everywhere, you know, so don't feel bad if I don't feature your project. But if you'd like me to give a shout out to something you're working on, to like a fundraiser, valuable things in the community, please let me know and DM me on Instagram. But I wanted to highlight a fundraiser done by Shelly at Printmakers Open Forum. Shelly's running a fundraiser called Lithosphere, where she's trying to get a giant 5-ton press, the 1966 mint condition Okuma flatbed lithography offset proofing press. Shelly has bought the press, is going to move it in, and her fundraiser thus far has actually reached its goal rather quickly. Like in a few days, like 5 days or something, she actually hit her goal to get the press in the building. But now it's a little more like she's needing to do like electrical work and things like that. So she's still pursuing a larger goal since it's going well. But definitely check out the Lithosphere. You can check it out at Printmakers Open Forum on Instagram. If you search Lithosphere, I doubt there's many things that'll pop up, but it's a really cool project and Shelly is great. I was lucky to meet her in New York and give it a check out and see if you might want to donate. And the reason I'm sharing this is because, you know, I did a fundraiser and people were generous enough to help me get back on my feet. And so I'm trying to just give back to people who I feel like would be a good campaign to support. Another one that I'm really enthusiastic about is Let's Leave a Press in Puerto Rico. It's a campaign being done by Joseph Velasquez of Drive-By Press. And it's basically when SGC goes to Puerto Rico next year, because of the storms and things that have really hurt the whole island in general. One thing that they decided was like, hey, how about when we go down there, we leave a printing press for the people there to use at the University of Puerto Rico, Rio Piedras. And so they're actually doing a fundraiser. It's on Indiegogo. It's indiegogo.com/projects/ Let's Leave a Press in Puerto Rico #. So just look up Let's Leave a Press and you'll find it. But it's a really good fundraiser. I've already donated and, you know, there's a few incentives, like people are donating prints, and so you can actually go on there and just like buy a print by someone, and then you get to, you know, collect the print and the donation goes towards something great. So hopefully we are able to raise some money. Right now they're at about $2,000 of their goal and we're trying to hit 15. So really what it'll come down to is like the more money we can raise, you know, there's shipping and a lot of things involved, which will cost some of the money, but we're trying to leave the biggest machine possible. So the more money, the bigger the press we can actually afford to ship down there. And it would be a huge benefit to the art community and to leave a lasting impact from Southern Graphics coming to the island next year. It's going to be great. So if you can share, or, you know, at least share the campaign or donate, I'm sure everyone will appreciate. And, you know, contact Joseph if you want to maybe get involved in other ways. Maybe you can donate a print. I'm not sure what the, you know, what the requirements are on that. But anyway, just trying to share some things and, you know, highlight some of the hard work that people are doing that's for the greater good. So anyway, this episode this week is a good one for people who are trying to figure out how to start a print shop. A lot of people need a space for their community to work, and Angie Leonard has really figured it out, you know, and she also offers that if you have any questions, you can freely contact her and ask her the things you want to know, like how do you find funding, how do you approach people for donations, and like how do you start a nonprofit, what's that process like. It's really a good interview with Angie, who has really figured out a lot over the 13 years that she's run her shop. And yeah, it was really great to finally talk to her and get some perspective on Sputnik Press. So enjoy the episode.
So now that I'm publishing work with artists, we each get to do our favorite parts, essentially. So the artist gets to do that heavy lifting, I think. And I get to just have fun making it. And I've also just come to really enjoy that relationship of working alongside artists and getting to kind of a very authentic connection to their studio practice. I know that there's a lot of art administrators that really wish they could have more of a studio practice or leave art administration to go back to get an MFA or something like that. But for me, I feel like I've really found a really good fit for me where I get to use my hands, but I think I'm better at running a studio than being an artist.
This is The Printcast, the best podcast about printmaking ever made.
It's common in the Midwest to have a DIY approach to life. Community is built in thanks to our agricultural roots, and even in the cities of the central U.S., there's a casual and approachable vibe that pervades daily life. It seems quite natural then that the Midwest is home to many powerful printmaking scenes, Chicago being a particular powerhouse where facilities, artists, and opportunities are abundant. Angie Leonard is one founder of such a place called Sputnik Press. It's a community shop providing open studios, memberships, classes, exhibitions, and many more community events. After 12 years, they've established a strong foundation upon which to build. With a diverse community of artists, they provide resources appreciated by printmakers and the print interested alike. As community shops go, it's a landmark that's worth a visit if you happen to find yourself in the Windy City. Angie Leonard, welcome to the Printcast.
Thanks, Nick. It's an honor to be here.
Yeah, well, it's great to have you on. And I think I mentioned it in some of our back and forth with the emails. Like, I've been looking to you, or kind of looking at Sputnik as like a model for, like, I don't know, like a really successful community print studio. You guys are really doing some great work in Chicago there.
Thanks. I'm not totally sure that we're worthy of that. And I think in part because I looked at so many other print shops. So I feel like we all kind of look to each other and pull the elements that make sense for our community.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense.
But thank you for the compliment.
Sure. Well, like, so who else do you look to? Because I know I have a few in my mind that I'm always like thinking about, but what other ones do you think are doing something right, at least?
I think two that I often go back to or look to and see what they're up to. One is AS220 in Providence.
Oh, of course. They're great.
Yeah. And they're, you know, their model's much different because they're in a much larger, not print-centric organization. But there's so many innovative ways that they're thinking about how to keep a community sustainable and vibrant. And then I also look to High Point Center for Print often as an organization that is doing what I think Sputnik strives to do of having all tiers of printmaking, and that they have youth programming, but they also do really amazing editioning work, education, kind of a little bit of everything. And they also seem to have their funding model stable.
Well, that's the hardest part, is like continuing to sustain financially is probably the hardest part of a community shop, because you're kind of battling like all these different things where it's like if you focus too much on art, it could be rather unstable, and like you can't guarantee you have enough income to keep going, right? But like you can have workshops and like ongoing programs that kind of sort of stabilize the revenue stream. I don't know. How do you approach it? How do you think about it?
Well, it's always changing, so that's fun. especially with classes, it's like a weird puzzle that we can never figure out what why some classes cancel and some classes run. Some classes have a huge wait list and we offer it again and no one signs up. So there's a lot of mysteries to how, what brings people to Sputnik, when and why. But I think something that has worked well for us, I'm happy about, is that we have a lot of different programs, which can be exhausting, but that also means that there can be ebb and flow between the programs financially, and they kind of even each other out. And as I think, as far as nonprofits go, we're unique in that we have a lot of earned income. So we do sell classes, we do charge for studio time. Lately, we've been selling more art, which has been really helpful. So we're not like 100% reliant on philanthropists, although that they're a huge piece of the puzzle. But
because you are like a registered nonprofit, right? Like,
yeah.
Yeah, so you can go after grant funding and give like tax write-offs to donors and things like that if that comes up, right?
Yeah, exactly.
But yeah, that's like a constantly, like I worked for, I think I told you in my email, I worked for a community print shop that was called Incubator Press in Kansas City years ago. And I remember, I knew a guy, I've been trying to place like Jeremy Lundquist. Is that his name? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yes, that's someone I know.
Yeah, I met him, I think, at an artist residency. I can't totally remember for sure, but in talking to him and getting to know that he was involved at Sputnik at the time, this is like way back, like 10 years ago or something. But yeah, I remember working at Incubator. I was trying to like find like what other shops are out there. So I was looking at similar ones that you're mentioning and trying to analyze like how do people do this? Like how do you generate revenue that's consistent, or how do you make it open enough that you can have like an open studio night where people can just show up and like come in and bring a screen and like make something just like one time, but then equally like provide to members and people who want like a stable, well-stocked facility that they can almost call their own studio, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's really complicated. Yeah. It's really difficult to figure out. And each city probably offers a different combination of things that you have to put together, right?
Yeah. Yeah. There's definitely tension there, but I think that the tension hasn't been a asset to Sputnik, but I think having the artist who calls Sputnik their home studio and having the person who comes in once a year to print a t-shirt before the band goes on tour, like that, those two very different types of printmakers or artists in the same space is really cool, but it's hard to balance because they have different needs.
Definitely, yeah. And some are very self-sufficient, whereas like if you have like a lot of newcomers coming in off and on or each week, it's like you need like monitors and stuff. So how do you mitigate that? Because I know I had a solution I was kind of like developing, and like tragically Incubator Press, like after I was there for about a year and a half, it just like abruptly closed and the nonprofit like folded and everything changed. But but I was starting to kind of seek out a way that was like semi-doable for me to like have just like people to help monitor. Like how do you have things set up to where it's like there's just like somebody on staff or on site who can just kind of keep everything under control? Like what is your solution to that?
Well, the longer we're around, we're kind of dialing it in more, but in the early days it was on a volunteer basis, and you would get a little bit of studio credit based on the number of hours you spent monitoring. Mm-hmm. And I think that worked when we were super small, but it's really not consistent because as soon as someone gets a job or moves away or they don't need to use a studio for whatever reason, they stop being monitors. So we ultimately switched things around and developed a whole educational program around the monitoring responsibility in a way. So our studio fellowship program now exists, which is an 8-month program that artists apply to. They apply with a project statement and some professional and artistic goals. They interview with us. And for those 8 months, they get to use the studio as much as they want. They get to take advantage of professional development seminars ran by our program director. They get like 50% off of all of our professional development opportunities. But then another key part is that they run one open studio session a week. So that is a huge help to us and really helps keep the studio running. It also helps keep the artists using the studio in a kind of in a leadership role that they have say about how things go and ownership over the studio. And I think for the fellows, for the artists that do this, they learn a lot about troubleshooting, about press operations, about studio maintenance. But there's also definitely days where someone comes in to maybe do a letterpress project, but the monitor on hand has only gone through our safety training. They've never actually made a letterpress print because they're experts in relief or etching or like all the other things we do.
Sure. Yeah.
And then that can be really hard for both the monitor who has to say, I can't help you, I'm sorry. And then the artist who's paying to be there and they hit some sort of bump and they don't have the support they want. So, you know, it's great 90% of the time, but there's definitely days that I wish we just had like five times as much staff so that we could always be there.
Well, that's the difficulty. Like, and it comes up in, you know, being a printer in the world, it's like when you apply for jobs and all these different things, it's just like you have to know so many things now, and there's so many methods and ways of printing and techniques and tricks and you know, nobody can really master all of it. Like I think we all try and we all want to say we do, or we lie on an application that we do, but it's like, you know, when push comes to shove, it's like there's a lot of nitty-gritty stuff, like when it comes to lithography or letterpress or even screen printing, which like seems simple enough when it's like not your first time trying it out, you know?
Right.
And you don't want like people coming in who are paying to be there who, yeah, leave frustrated or kind of don't achieve what they're trying to, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And our studio has more processes that, not well, it existed, but that was in the print department when I went to school. So things like risography wasn't really a thing.
Yeah.
And then letterpress was in the graphic design department. So, and then now we just added really basic paper making, but that's a whole other thing that's often not in the print department. So yeah, it's really unrealistic for someone to graduate from a BFA program and feel 100% grounded in every corner of the studio.
Yeah. Well, those are great additions though. Like that's all really cool stuff and it all fits together ultimately, right? I mean, if you can like figure out how to make paper, that's one thing I have like very little knowledge of, you know, and, but I print on handmade paper like every week, basically for doing letterpress work. And like, it's amazing. Like the qualities of like that paper versus anything else that I've ever printed on. It's, you know, it's hard to beat, but, so like when you started your studio, like it was like a live work thing, right? Like you were living in it and you launched it like in your own apartment. Was that what happened?
Yeah. Exactly. So about a year out of school, I had a press, in storage, and knew that I needed a studio space and basically moved to an apartment with a blessing from the landlord that I could set up this alternative space. So it was like a old neighborhood bar that had been converted into like an open floor plan loft apartment. And it was basically the whole front part of the apartment. And then there was some IKEA bookshelves to make a barrier. And then it was my kitchen.
Wow.
It worked because it was very small scale and because I was right out of school and had low living standards.
Totally. Yeah.
Yeah, but it worked. Not forever. But
yeah. Well, how long was it after like starting there? Like, did you move to like, I think you've moved a couple times, but like, what was the next big space? Like, how long were you there for?
Yeah, we moved about a year and a half after it officially opened. I think maybe 2 years after I lived in the apartment. And we moved to the building that we're in right now, but a much smaller studio. So we took over a lease. We subletted from another arts collective that they themselves moved to a different space in the building. So it's pretty small. It's like, I don't remember how big it was. It was like one large room.
Yeah.
And that was our first leap. And that's when it had to start sustaining itself financially. And that was bumpy, but obviously we figured it out because we're still here.
Yeah, no, it had to be a hard transition because like, yeah, all of a sudden, like, you know, it's one thing when you're living there, it's like the rent is like kind of like your rent and it, you know, there's like it's much more doable somehow when you're kind of living on site where your business is, but yeah, when you sever that tie, it's like it's got to stand on its own. And it's like, what were some of the early ways that you figured that out? I'm sure it got like tight at times, but it's like, did you start throwing like a big yearly event or something, or like how did you keep it going?
Yeah, I guess Well, about 6 months or something like that into being in the official legit space that had to pay rent, we were definitely running out of money. And I just was working my full-time job and then putting all the money towards the studio, which didn't feel too great. But at that time, we also were, as far as our like business standing was, we were a sole proprietorship. So it was me doing business as Sputnik Press. And that those like financial challenges is what ultimately led me to take the leap into making it a nonprofit organization, which opened us up to grants, which still took a couple of years to start really getting, because there's like a learning curve there. And then we started to do more fundraisers. And we also just started to talk about our space a little bit differently. And I think that it's a subtle, even if you're running a space that is really community oriented, if it is legally yours, not a community space, I think people are more hesitant to jump in and support it, both financially and with opinions and time and resources.
Sure. Yeah.
So the biggest change that helped us through that time, I think, was actually becoming a nonprofit instead of a for-profit.
And I'm curious, like with that, like, did you, cause like being, you know, it's not like the hardest thing in the world to become a nonprofit, but it does take like a whole lot of work and like legal assistance. And from what I've like been told and stuff, it's like a year of worth of work, right? Or more.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of that is just waiting, but
yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I think, I'm sure a lot of urban places have this, but there's a organization in Chicago called Lawyers for the Creative Arts. Mm-hmm. And they offer a workshop for helping you through the nonprofit application, and then like $100 fee to have a one-on-one consultation just to review your application. So we took advantage of both of those things. And then there's also a grant, a city grant that supported individual artists. One of the things you could apply for is funding to submit a nonprofit application.
Oh, wow. Cool.
So that's what helped pay for the fee, which is something like $750 or something that you just have to give to the government to allow them to have the resources to review your application.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Without those things, I feel like I would have just felt really stuck and overwhelmed by it. But
I can't tell you how many times, like, I haven't done anything in LA, but in Kansas City, like, there was, like the Volunteer Lawyers Association was so valuable, like many different times where it's like we either had like super serious business questions or we wanted to know like how should we incorporate the business. They were super, super helpful, and like usually they just work pro bono, which is amazing. And it's like what would we artists do without groups like that, you know?
Right.
One thing I know from just other people I know who like write grants and things and like stuff I've done, is that when you get a grant, it only funds like maybe like the program you're writing it for. So say if it's like professional development or something, it's like you can get a good chunk of money to like pay for an instructor for that and for materials and like scholarship or, you know, mm-hmm. sort of different things. But it's like, it's not usually money that'll pay like your utility bill for Sputnik Press, or it won't pay like you to be the owner of it or the, you know, your rent maybe. But it's like, how do you navigate that? And like, I'm just looking maybe too, like, could you illuminate like how those generally work? Just cause I don't know if everyone understands like the limitations that come with like, you know, say it's a grant for like $30,000 or something. It's not like you just have 30 grand to do with as you please, and it doesn't solve all your problems. You know, it's like, it's kind of a thing you have to figure out how to make it work.
Right. Well, I don't know how granular your listeners might want me to go.
I have no idea. Yeah, I don't know.
Because budgets is kind of a beast, even if you're looking at a spreadsheet, let alone listening to a podcast. But so one thing that is helpful in being able to have a grant, maybe for a particular program, fund a portion of things like rent and staff, is that you can write your budget so that you allocate out the what's called overhead across your program. So if you have, I'll use Sputnik as an example. We have a studio use program, we have an education program, and we have a residency program. We have other ones too, but don't stick with that for now. So that if I say, our staff spends 25% of the time on the residency, 50% on studio use, 25% on the other program. I can say my salary goes in those proportions to those things, and our rent goes in those proportions to those things. So
interesting.
Some bands can fund a portion of your overhead. You just can't double dip. You can't tell one grantor that the residency is half of your time and another grantor that another program is 75% of your time. You know, it has to all work out to be 100% of your time.
Yeah, because really you have to report at the end like where all this went, and usually even provide documentation, right? So it's like, it's not like especially with the bigger the grant, like the more work it is on the front and back end of it, I think.
Yeah, definitely. But another thing about how our programs are set up is basically some programs funnel money into other programs. So we've been doing more invitational publishing with artists, more like a traditional, you know, like Gemini or Crown Point model, where we invite the artist in, we produce the work, we split the work at the end, we sell the work to fund that project and more. So that program is helping us do things like our residency that there's just really no way for it to make money, and it'd be weird if we tried to monetize it.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah, and I think I've had staff that are like less comfortable with the budget side of things be really concerned, like, my program is like bleeding money, and I'm like, of course, it's nonprofit.
Yeah.
That's why we're here, is so that we can spend that money to support artists who aren't giving us money. But you know, it's definitely a tricky puzzle and tricky to figure out just how much one thing should or can be offsetting another thing. And yeah, I think like we're sort of at a point where, you know, we can like increase fees and tuition at the same sort of rate as inflation, but it would be contradictory to our mission to make big jumps. So now we're at a point where if we want to grow or we want to invest more in our mission, we have to get more donations. There's just, that's where that funding has to come from, I think, to be kind of an immoral, more good moral ground.
Yeah, no, I know. Well, so how do you, so part of that, you know, when you're going for like big donors and stuff, like there's lots of people who philanthropically support the arts, you know, and I'm sure there'd be an audience that would definitely like engage and really enjoy what you're offering and creating, because I think you're really creating something valuable. But do you, like, how do you network into the class of, I don't know how to talk about it without being awkward, I guess, but it's like, there's like an elite class who like we have to go to for this type of thing. And what I've experienced, and I even have friends who I think about this when I talk to them, it's like we, being artists, like we generally don't have a lot of money to work with, but that sort of goes with the lifestyle. But we have all these other freedoms and things we get to enjoy and do. And it's difficult to like network into like kind of, you know, a more well-to-do sort of class of society who like, those are the people, you know, it's like if you hate money and you resent the rich, it's like those are the people who will fund the programs that you're trying to create at the same time. And I'm not saying we all hate the rich or anything, but you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's not the most natural fit. So how do you navigate like getting, meeting those people and even doing stuff like that?
Yeah.
It seems so difficult.
Well, first of all, I don't claim to be an expert on this at all. So I'm not speaking from a place of authority, but I do think that I totally get that framework or that like mindset of like, oh, these rich people, this other species, I don't quite understand. But I think there are really sleazy rich people, but I also think there's a lot of people who have wealth that are incredibly kind, generous souls, and they use their wealth for good. I think we all, you know, kind of know that, but
yeah, sure, most definitely.
But I think like the mindset of kind of not understanding this other type of person is like a wall. And that you never know who has money and who doesn't have money, and you also all networks in really complex ways. So I think like, as an example, the people who come to our studio, a lot of them work for people who have a lot of money. They don't have money, but if they can invite their boss to a fundraiser, maybe that boss will bring a couple of their friends, and then maybe one or two of them will bid on one or two artworks. And then now you have another $2,000. And it's not like, You didn't have to like go to some weird ball or something to like find these people.
Like you're at the black and white ball at the museum or something. And
yeah, and you're like infiltrating and trying to spy who's wearing like the biggest watch. Like it's much more organic. And it's definitely a long game. There's people that I've met that I have had on my radar for years, and over 3 or 4 years, I get to the point where I feel comfortable directly asking them to make a donation. Because you have to have some sort of friendship is too strong of a word, but relationship.
Yeah.
And it has to be genuine. And if it's not genuine, then I don't know. At least for an organization our size, it doesn't work. I think if maybe we were like the American Red Cross or something, you know, your mission and your global impact is of a scale that you don't need the personal relationship. They can only be attached to your mission. But I don't think that really scales down to a small nonprofit, especially one that's like, you know, I think printmaking is not that niche, but really it's kind of niche.
It kind of is. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
But no, that's a really valuable point though. Like it is totally about the relationships, and like I haven't worked in development. I've like thought about it a little bit over time, but my mother is actually like a whiz at development and fundraising, and like on this like way bigger scale than I can even really understand. Like she's like a natural at it, but she and I have talked like a ton about just like how she builds like these relationships. And you know, and on her, at her level, she was kind of running a museum basically, so she was like going and meeting like with, you know, people who like had huge houses in Chicago full of Mooka prints all over the walls and paintings, and like they just like, but like those were the people that like kept the museum alive and kept it going, and like they were, you know, the key to the museum expanding that she was working at which was in Iowa. This is in Iowa, but
I think, sorry.
Oh, go ahead.
Well, I'm reminded of that phrase that if when volunteers volunteer your organization, you're providing them a service because they want to feel good about volunteering, and you're providing them that opportunity. It's kind of a volunteer coordination trick or something to keep in mind.
Sure.
And I think the same sort of thing is true with donors. Like you're providing them a service. You're providing them access to something they want access to, whether it's getting to meet artists personally, whether it is, you know, them to leave their black tie and suit and conference room life to connect with people who are maybe more in touch with their artistic side. So it's like a two-way street. They're supporting you, but you're also doing something for them. And I think that's makes a more genuine connection, which I think ultimately is to my money.
That's a great way to look at it. Yeah, no, it does go both ways. And there is a benefit to it like that. And do you have, so the same sort of issues come up when you're trying to sell, you know, like nice fine artwork or like these kind of publishing projects that you're doing. How do you find the audience for those or a potential buying public? Do you have exhibitions like at your studio, or do you do them in galleries and other areas around Chicago?
Well, we do have a gallery space in our studio. It's a multi-purpose space, so that presents challenges. and I think figuring out how we exhibit the work and promote the work is definitely a next big project for us. But for us, a big boon was when we first participated in Art Expo. Art Expo Chicago, big art fair here.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that took, we had been talking about it for years, and it took years to have the, you know, the fee to participate, to feel like that was money we could potentially spend and not earn back. But we did it for the first time 2 years ago, and it went really well, and I think a lot of people in Chicago had heard about us, but they had to see us alongside world-class galleries to have that aha moment of like, oh, I should pay attention to them.
Yeah.
Because I think before that we were sort of like, oh, they're a cool, like, you know, community grassroots place helping some people who just graduated school. And I think getting into the art fair and being alongside, you know, a different sort of class, I don't know if that's the right word or not, but of studios and galleries just shifted people's perceptions. We didn't change, but they just started to see us in a different context. And so now we can continue those relationships. Everyone who bought work or expressed interest in work, now we can reach out to them directly when we release new work. And I don't know, there's a lot of like residual opportunities that have come from being at that art fair in particular. And now we're trying to figure out how to be in other art fairs.
Wow, that's really cool. Yeah, because there's all kinds of stuff in Chicago. I mean, you guys have a ton of things going on. And I've heard really great things about Expo. Like people from Kansas City go up there, and galleries from KC like make their way there. I think I even had a piece in it once. I can't remember now.
Oh.
I should figure out if that happened, like what that was.
Yeah, you should know about that. We were in the precursor to Art Expo called the Next Fair in like 2008 or 2009 when we were super young. And we had this like little capsule machine where you could like, usually candy would come in it, but we put little 1-inch by 1-inch prints in it.
Oh, cool. I love those. Yeah.
Yeah. And it costs like $1 to get, you know, you just put your quarters in, turn to the handle. And recently we took our fellows to the MCA, the artist book collection, and they had them all.
Oh, no
so
way.
Some curator at the MCA stopped by and like spent $4. But now all those artists have work at the MCA in the permanent collection.
Oh, that's so cool.
Yeah, it's really cool. I mean, that's the magic of prints and multiples. And actually maybe a nod to like how you can work within the museum context and the highbrow art gallery context, but also still kind of hold on to that democratic root that I think draws so many of us to print.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. It's, I think any of us who are like really diehard printers kind of like to ride that line. And I don't know, there's something about it. We're always driven to make multiples of everything we make. What do you do in your creative work? Do you find time to make your own work at the studio?
Essentially, no, but I get asked that question a lot.
Sure, yeah.
And it took me a while to decide how I feel about it. But essentially these days, I don't really have my own artistic practice. What I do get to do that I just absolutely love is I get to publish work with other artists, which is something I've been doing the last 3 years, maybe. So to me, it's like the absolute best, because the part that I was always challenged with is the content of the work. And I'm kind of one of those people that discredits my idea before I get it on paper.
As far I know as that, yes.
Visual art goes. And I felt really challenged and overwhelmed by the content creation of the artwork. But the technical side is just, it's my jam and I love it. So now that I'm publishing work with artists, we each get to do our favorite parts, essentially. So the artist gets to do that heavy lifting, I think. And I get to just have fun making it. And I've also just come to really enjoy that relationship of working alongside artists and getting to kind of a very authentic connection to their studio practice. I know that there's a lot of art administrators that really wish they could have more of a studio practice or leave art administration to go back to get an MFA or something like that. But for me, I feel like I've really found a really good fit for me where I get to use my hands, but I think I'm better at running a studio than being an artist.
Well, that's like, that's a really valuable insight to gain for yourself. And I know I've had very similar experiences in my own way. And I think a lot of artists, like, I mean, what the fact is like most of us who go to school, like often like most of us aren't going to continue to make work, but we end up in creative fields or related fields, you know?
Yeah.
And there's really nothing wrong with that. And for me, it's like, for whatever reason, there's this like inner being or voice that like just cannot let go of the fact that it's just like, man, I wish I had more time to do stuff. And yet I constantly create new projects that take up my time that that time could be used for making things, you know?
Right. And a while ago, if you asked me 3 or 4 years ago, I would have felt much more conflicted about how to answer that. But I acknowledge that exact same thing of, I would say, oh, I have a day, I should work in the studio. And then I would like start a spreadsheet to figure out our next class schedule. And I'm like, why am I doing this?
Yeah.
Is it because I actually like it better and just feel guilty that I like it better?
It's almost like we need therapy or something to really like settle it in our minds. I don't know
your art school experience, but I do think art schools contribute to the problem of representing that being a studio artist is a sexier, more valid way to be in the arts than being an administrator.
I think that's probably true. They do. That is the main thing they emphasize. It's not like you can get your major to be in arts administration, or at least not at most programs. I don't think they do that. And it's definitely like looked at as like a, the response would be like, I'm not making work anymore. And it's just like, oh, that's too bad. You know, it's just like,
exactly.
it's always this exalted thing that we have to like make things. And it's like, and it's not even just that. It's like, you have to make it for a gallery. You have to make it to get further in the career and keep climbing the ladder. And, and it's what I love is I see more and more people just making stuff. And I feel like they're making it for themselves because they want to. Like these days, yeah. like things are shifting and changing a lot, I think. More DIY,
Yeah. And I think a few years ago, I would be kind of pissed when someone would be like, oh, I'm so sorry you're not making work. I'm like, don't freaking pity me.
Yeah.
I have a career. And I think I've flipped now to like being a spokesperson for like arts administration is fun and rewarding. And then I also have had more in my like home life, a connection to crafting, like complete lowbrow, no purpose to it, totally decorative.
Yeah.
And I don't show it to, anyone but my friends, but it makes me happy. And that's why I went to art school in the first place, is because I like drawing. I didn't know anything yet about the museum world or the gallery world. I just knew I liked drawing.
Yeah, no, I think that's why, a lot of us, I think, got into it because we just gravitated towards it. I was always into creative stuff when I was a kid, not that I thought I'd be an artist like I am today at all, but things just kind of unfolded that way and I just kept following it,
Right.
Where did you grow up? Are you from Chicago originally?
No, I'm from Michigan.
Okay.
I feel like I'm supposed to expand upon that, but I'm not sure.
You don't have to. I mean, I'm from Iowa. I don't have a whole lot to say. The college years were interesting and I learned a lot, but yeah, it's interesting too when you're talking about being a printer, a collaborative printer, I guess I should say. When I was in college or after college, before grad school, I was like looking at like, what should I do with my life? And I actually wanted to become a master printer. And I was like convinced for some reason that I was like, this is something I could definitely do. And I went to Bob Glasgow, who was like the lithography teacher at Iowa. And he basically talked me out of it. And he said, like, you'll never make your own work again. Like, this is not for someone who wants to make art for themselves. It's just you're this like, you're a conduit for other people to make their work. And you're like the technician and the artist, working on the machines, making the plates, doing all the technical things. And it's weird. It's like in a lot of ways at the time I was really grumpy about it, but it's like Bob was totally right in a way, but it's like, but there's lots of people who do both and like kind of defy that, that path too.
Yeah. And I think, there's lots of people who say, at least as in a more mature form would say, great, that's what I want.
Yeah. I think at the time my ego couldn't separate from that. And, and then it's funny cause like, if I look back over like, the 10 or 15 years, like after that, it's like, I basically followed that model, like really slowly, like away from making stuff for myself at least, and just making stuff for other people became the thing. And I don't know, for me, it was like the writing was on the wall already. I just kind of didn't, I didn't understand it and I didn't know myself well enough at the time, maybe,
Right.
But yeah, so at Sputnik, like what all types of equipment and space do you have? And I know there's like lots of programs. So if you want to like rattle off like the different things you offer, like from internships and workshops and all of it, to the different mediums you guys focus on.
Yeah. We do a lot. Our goal is to be a little bit more broad, kind of a moniker we say sometimes is we have something for anyone who wants to be creative through print. So creative through print can mean a lot of things. So I don't want to rattle things off in a way that's just a giant list. But as far as programs, I think we kind of think about them as studio access, so ways that people can produce work. So that's like our open studio drop-in program, hourly rental, keyholder access, the 24-hour rental. And then we have education. So there's adult classes. We also have youth workshops that come through. We have private lessons. We have very softly educational things, like a program we call Drink and Draw. That's like a feeder program. A lot of people check us out through that program. It's a little less intimidating.
Yeah, cool. Those are great.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. And then we have like presentation and support programs. We have like our exhibitions program, our fellowship and our residency that provide access to artists with slightly different focuses on where they're at in their career and what they need. And our membership program is not totally a separate thing. It's kind of like interwoven into all of that. But one thing that we've been doing the last few years is we've used our membership, which is a way you can legally and literally buy into our organization, not like a food co-op, but like you can vote on who joins our board and things like that. We've used that program as a sort of professional networking program. So through that, we offer our members portfolio reviews and what we call offsite visits, which are like adult field trips to cool places.
Oh, cool. Like
galleries and museums and private collectors' houses and established studio spaces for artists farther in their career. And then we have like a member exhibition and things like that, that we try to like build support for our artists beyond just the art making and more about all the things that come before and after the art making. Yeah, those are like the major like legs of our programs, but they can all be like dissected down to be smaller programs, programs within programs.
Man, it's so much. You've developed quite a monster of a thing. There's so many aspects of it. It's so
it's a good way of putting it.
And it, I mean, and it all, it, the beauty of it is it all kind of feeds itself. So it's like, you know, you have one arm of it, but it's like that part supports a different part, and it like, it's very circular and supportive in nature, which I think is great.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. We try to support artists more across their career, or I think something a lot of print shops, I see a lot of print shops that just kind of support the project, not necessarily the artist. So we're thinking a little bit more about how to be there for the artist, whether they're currently making a print right now or not. But it makes for a pretty confusing model and a little bit hard to distill down the essence of what we do, especially if you're not a printmaker.
Sure. Yeah. I could see that.
But I stand by it. I think it's an important, it's an important service we provide.
Sure. I mean, so one thing, you know, in looking up you and, you know, I was just doing like general searches for Chicago stuff. Like one thing that's been really funny for me, I don't know, over the past year especially, is that like I've always known of some of the stuff that goes on in Chicago, and I went to SGCI in Chicago. It was like a blast. Mm-hmm. I had a lot of fun, and there was just like cool stuff everywhere too, like really impressive collections and the center of the book. I mean, just like great stuff everywhere, but it seems like how, with the things that were already established and existing, what made you start a studio? I think there's another one called like Chicago Printmaker Collective or something like that.
Yeah, collaborative, but yeah.
Collaborative, yeah. And like what made you start your own versus like becoming a part of that one? Or is it like a regional thing where you kind of service like a different part of the city or a different audience? Or I was just kind of curious.
Yeah, I think that, well, at this point in time, it's definitely our geographic location in the city helps determine which shop someone might go to. The Chicago printmaking community, I'd say at this point, is really tight-knit. We have a organization called the Chicago Printers Guild. That's like a professional guild you can join for like $25 a year. It's started by Nadine Nakanishi, who's half of Sonnen Zimmer, or it might have been started by all of Sonnen Zimmer. Nick might have also helped with that too. But that's helped all the printmakers that are in these sort of different niches of print, like gig poster designers, fine art editioners, commercial shops, all get to know each other and resource share more. I'm answering your question kind of out of order. That came after Sputnik started, but that's how I felt actually more connected to the broader print community.
I came across the Guild, and it was like, I mean, what a cool thing. Like, I don't know if Los Angeles has one of those or not, but like, it would be so cool to be able to go to something that's just like, almost just like free to join up and be a part of.
It's great. And I think they have some ambitious goals that they're working on, but just the basic essence of like, they meet once a month and they meet in a different studio and they just rotate who hosts the meetings. So if you're new, if you're just graduated or you just moved here, you know, stay in it for a year or two and you're going to see, you know, 20 different studios and see how they set it up and hear about how they run it. And it's a huge asset. Like, it's amazing.
It's like a rare thing. And I mean, plus like you have to have like a lot of like working and active print artists who, you know, can facilitate something like that happening and working like that, you know?
Yeah. I guess it's the benefit of being in a large city.
Yeah. I mean, like, you know, Kansas City is not nearly as big, but it's like, we never had anything that was like a unifying force like that.
Yeah. And I think the Guild functions in a nice way because they're not like overlords of the print scene or anything like that.
Yeah.
It's very casual, even though they also do some pretty cool, impactful things. It's like chill. Anyone can join. The requirements are like you make a print once a year or something very minimal. You know, they're not gatekeepers or anything like that.
Yeah. Let me see.
Yeah, and I guess I didn't fully answer.
Yeah, I think I interrupted you. Yeah, go ahead if you want to go back to that.
I think first of all, when I graduated, I was a much more shy and I guess less secure person. So I was a little overwhelmed by some of the more established shops. So there's Anchor Graphics, which is unfortunately now defunct. And Chicago Printmakers Collaborative was around. And they both, you know, are amazing resources. But I think both financially and then just sort of like feeling comfortable in a shop, they were both a little bit overwhelming to me. And I sensed that there was a lack of a place for people to go that were fresh out of school or maybe didn't even have a formal education and just kind of needed to like screw up a little bit and not feel like, oh no, I'm in this like really nice space that I'm going to hurt. So, you know, again, that makes friction when people come into our space and aren't technically the best printers.
Sure. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But I think that like approachability and, you know, avoiding any sort of like portfolio review or like hoops or bars to jump through is what made me decide I wanted to start my own.
So you were just like, you had a different ethos that you felt like could serve people in a different way, and obviously there's an audience big enough that all of them can sort of function all these different models, right? Like,
yeah. And I started it kind of naively. I mean, I was young, I didn't have the global view of how Chicago's print scene works way back then.
Yeah.
I think just being in tune with my own feelings about, well, like insecurity in a super established, clean shop and knowing that sort of democratic social side of printmaking is a huge part of what I was doing. I didn't want to just show up and be an artist in a space like wearing headphones, making a print. Like I needed the people and the collaboration, which I'm sure would happen in other shops, but.
Well, let's see. So we're getting towards time, but do you have any like upcoming like happenings or openings or workshops or any kind of thing that you want to mention to the audience out there?
Oh gosh. I should have jotted some things down before we started the interview because I didn't really think about the opportunity to plug things. But I guess right now we are working with our first resident artist of 2019, Andrea Carlson. who's been in the studio making some really amazing screen prints. So we're going to have an artist talk in conversation with her and a couple of other artists and curators at the end of July. One other thing I may be excited about, I think this might be the first time announcing this. I don't think anyone really knows yet. Our fall benefit, our annual benefit, it's not till October, so this is like a far-reaching plug. But I'm really excited because we're going to get to honor the artist Audrey Niffenegger, who is one of the founding members of the Columbia College Center for Book and Paper Arts.
Oh, wow, cool.
Yeah, and I think that that program is, you know, I guess going back to what you're saying about Chicago, having all these great communities, I feel like that space helped make Chicago a city that can kind of keep absorbing and supporting more printmakers. so I'm excited to get to honor her and her work in the print community and the writing community.
I saw in another interview, I think it was one of the ones you sent me, that you had this concept in your mind, if you were to do something different, that you would open a diner kind of Cheers bar combination based on like the Gilmore Girls, Gilmore Girls coffee shop and Cheers the bar, which I thought was funny. I was asking one of my previous guests. Yeah. Like, and I was asking them, like, you know, if you weren't in this field that you're in now, like what else would you do? And I thought that was a really funny, funny answer. It sounded like a cool place that, I don't know, I think could actually work in today's world for sure.
Yeah. I'm really thinking about it. It's just really not sensical. but I was telling friends about this like weird idea and they're like, oh, so you want to start a city? And I was like, yeah, I just want to start like this like utopian space, but it would have to be in a whole utopian city for it to really work. So I'm not really expecting that to happen, but yeah.
But yeah, and also I wanted to just bring this up because this is like near and dear to my heart, more like, you know, the Nick who grew up in Iowa person. But like, I saw that you play euchre, or you mentioned that you play euchre in one of these interviews. And I just think that's funny. Was it something like where you grew up where like everybody played euchre all the time? Or like, how did you fall into playing euchre, the card game I'm referring to, for people who don't know what it is?
Right. So, yeah, I mean, euchre is really big in Michigan. And I think my parents taught me and my brother when I was like 8 or something. And at the time, I was like, this is such a stupid, boring game. But now it's definitely, something that connects my Chicago friends, if they're from Michigan or Wisconsin, usually, maybe Indiana. So I play here with my friends that come from those states. but I still play when I go home and play with my parents and play with my aunt and uncle. And I don't know why I love it so much. It's just like a pastime.
Well, it's just something, it's so easy to play. And I don't know. Yeah. And it, like all throughout high school, it was like the main pastime. You know, we'd hang out at someone's house and play euchre just like endlessly. And it just gets so fun and you can like shoot the shit and like make fun of each other and like get competitive. And it's just such a good time.
I think it's really easy unless you, I know the Bowers really trip up my friends that I've taught that didn't grow up with it.
Well, yeah. And if you think like now, like the word Trump has like a totally new meaning too, which is like, that's always bothered me that word is now, I don't know, tainted or changed. But yeah, where I grew up, I'm from Dubuque, Iowa, and it's like far east Iowa, like right on the Mississippi where it borders with Illinois, Wisconsin, and Iowa. Mm-hmm. It's like the point where all three states meet. And in Dubuque, it's like if you're a Dubuquer, you play euchre. It was like kind of this thing where like,
oh, wow,
pretty much anybody, like, yeah, anybody you'd meet up with, it's like you could just pull a card game together. And it's been weird since I've like moved on and gone to different places in the country and stuff. It's just like, I don't know a lot of people who play anymore. I think I'd have to find like some Midwest people or teach people.
Yeah. In Chicago, there's a couple of like Michigan bars. I haven't spent time in them, but they'll play like MSU games, Michigan State University games. And have euchre tournaments. And I'm not really a sports person, so that has kept me away from them. But I know that there are a couple of bars that have euchre tournaments for all of Michigan's and you know, this region's transplants.
Yeah. Well, I think we're pretty close on time. So is there anything else you want to mention before we head out?
Well, it's been an honor. It's been a pleasure. Good conversation. I'll just put out there that I really like talking shop. And I think that if people are in other cities, other locations running a space or trying to run a space, like, I want to be a resource. I want you to be a resource for me too. But I'm happy to talk to more people more granularly about what's worked for us, what hasn't, things like that.
That's fantastic. Yeah. And that's like a really hard thing to find, because when you're doing what you're doing, it's hard to know who you would ask about a lot of things. But that's partly why I wanted to have you on, is just to discuss some aspects of this work that you're doing. Not that we can get into the granular detail, but it's not easy doing what you're doing. And I commend you for everything you've accomplished. It's really fantastic. You're still up and running and just doing all this cool stuff. It's really good.
Well, thanks. It's with lots and lots of help.
I'm sure. It takes a community, yeah. Right? Like,
yep.
All right. Well, thank you for coming on the Printcast. I really appreciate you making time. And yeah, I'll definitely point people to you as I promote the episode, and I'll let you know like when it comes out and stuff. So
cool. That sounds great.
Okay.
Thanks, Nick.
Yeah. Thank you.
You've been listening to The Printcast, a podcast about print shops, the artist, the process, and all the things we make. If you like what you're listening to, help us get the word out by subscribing and leaving a 5-star review and sharing with your friends on social media. You can find The Printcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, as well as on the website printcast.com. Music for the show is by Jazar. Voiceover provided by Jim Bertzall and Rhiannon Bertzall. Take care of yourselves and each other, and we'll see you again on another episode of The Printcast. Bye for now.